Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Pinkerton's Ghosts is a horror anthology podcast by Superversive Radio, with no affiliation with any detective agency, person, real or imagined, or the dark forces of Outre Terre. It is not intended for children.
This is Jim Donovan. I'm reporting from my swanky hospital room in downtown Monroe, Washington. It is 10 a.m. I got the text from Control at 2 a.m. early last week. Production on the film Yotsuya Kaiden has been delayed due to a string of accidental deaths. Investigate the Washington film set to see if it's related to the Oiwa curse. Meet director Yukio Hattori for details.
Oh boy.
Well, I always wondered what would happen when the overseas Outre Terre went international. And I don't just mean elf royalty vacationing at Boca Raton and flirting with Sean. Yotsuya Kaiden is an old Japanese play about an actual, real-life ghost story. A samurai got tired of his wife and wanted the daughter of his richer neighbor. So he conspired with his best friend and the younger girl's father to kill his wife. He poisoned her, and the poison grossly deformed her face rather than outright kill her. The samurai asked his friend to rape his wife so that he could do the honorable thing and divorce her. Yeah, I don't understand Japanese marriages either. But his friend took pity on her, couldn't do it, and instead held up a mirror to show her how hideous the poison had made her. She went into a frenzy and killed herself, and her ghost haunted the samurai, his intended, and her father. Every time a play or film was made about this event, production disasters occurred in droves, much like how in the West, the play Macbeth is cursed. Well, the latest entertainment gossip blogs were talking about the various accidents in the production. Some wires had snapped, causing the lead stunt double to break both of her arms and a leg. One of the supporting actors died in a car crash, and one of the writers tripped on a cord and went face-first through plate glass. You know, the little things. The director, Yukio Hattori, was a young Japanese-American from Washington, who wanted to film in his home state rather than on location in Japan in order to cut costs. So, Control, I don't really have much experience with Japanese ghosts, oni, or monsters. Common sense dictates that you should be vulnerable to all the same stuff American ghosts are. I mean, the dead are the dead, no matter where they find themselves dispossessed. So I packed my usual ghost hunting gear and drove up north. Once again, I had to drive to avoid getting stopped by TSA for my various gadgets, gizmos, and weapons. I had been experimenting, as I often do. First of all, I had rock salt shotgun shells. Got that from watching a cheesy ghost hunting TV show. Should work in practice, since salt is a purifying agent and tends to work pretty good on ghosts. It's also not going to be as lethal to humans as regular steel pellets, just in case someone gets caught in the crossfire. I also packed a surgical electrocauterizer that I had modified to provide a wider effect. Think of it like putting a shotgun shell into a precision revolver. You'd be surprised what you can get at a police auction. Ghosts are basically energy. Energy cannot be created or destroyed. It can only be converted into matter or other forms of energy. I cannot figure out how to transform them into matter, even with the Soul Stone, but with enough of an electrical charge, I should be able to short-circuit the spiritual energy, keeping them anchored to this plane. Probably. Maybe. Look, most of my ideas are works in progress. I'm not going to start changing that now. At least my disembodied assistant, Gordon O'Hedisey, said that my reasoning was solid. And then he asked me to pick up some bison steaks on my way back from Washington. I can't say he's got a good head on his shoulders, but I will say his priorities are in order. Other than those two unique items, I packed my usual Colt 1911, my Soul Stone, and my shotgun. The ghost shouldn't be able to throw anything at me that I can't handle. It took me 3 days to drive far enough north. Had to fight off a troll on one of the more isolated portions of the I-5. It wasn't a very interesting fight, Control, but suffice to say, the Billy Goat's Gruff must have been packing some serious firepower. I pulled into Monroe, Washington, a small town a bit northeast of Seattle. The majority of production was housed here, since most of the filming was done in Index, Washington, a town further east that had next to no hotels, inns, or even Wi-Fi connection. That might sound confusing, but I assure you, it's normal. I identified myself to the director, explained who I was, why I was here, etc. He was chain-smoking the entire time I was standing there. I was under the impression that the film was over budget and behind schedule, and since Yukio was a pretty new director, if he didn't at least make the studio their money back, he'd be in a world of hurt come his next big idea. I got his permission to go to set. Filming was on hold for the next week out of respect for the third casualty of the film, so I wasn't going to be interfering with any actors or whatever. I drove to the little town of Index. Little? Tiny. A couple hundred people total. Just past the town proper, the movie had erected an entire 17th century Japanese village. It was really, really impressive. There had to be a lot of money put into this thing. There was even a replica of a Japanese castle nearby. One of those massive, weird structures with the upward slanting awnings and tile roofs and white walls. I'm always amazed at what Hollywood can make if they feel motivated to. I mean, come on. I'm in rural Washington, and there are cherry blossom trees in full bloom. Of course, they're probably all fake. And a full Edo period castle. I'm in medieval Japan, and I'm loving it! I could only imagine what it would be like if the set were active, or hot, as they say. There'd be samurai walking around, women in kimonos, geishas, all kinds of neat things. Now, though? Literal ghost town. Not even a security guard. The breeze began to blow. It was still winter, but in the Pacific Northwest, that mostly just means rain every other day. But in the Pacific Northwest, that mostly just means rain every day, as opposed to rain every other day. And sure enough, the sun was blocked out by dark clouds. It wasn't raining yet, but I could smell it coming. I heard a high-pitched grumbling cry behind me. It's always behind me. And from out of the forest, lumbered a tiny bear cub. Shaggy, brown, and adorable. It was playing on the wooden stairs leading up to what looked like a bar or sake den or something like that. The little bear would tumble down the stairs, crawl back up, and then tumble down again. My blood ran cold, because where there's a cub, there is a mother. I watched a big, burly, highly protective she-bear emerge from the forest. It didn't see me yet, but the way its head was swiveling and it was sniffing the air, it smelled me. I held the soul stone in my left hand and relaxed my eyes so I could see the threads of reality. I went a little bit deeper than usual so that I could mask my scent and adjust the light rays bouncing off of me. This was one of those I've done it in theory in my own apartment kind of magics that I've never really put into practice. I kind of smoothed out my profile so that the sun rays bounced away from the direction of the bear. And I put up a kind of force field, I guess, so that there were no odors emanating from my body. Past a couple inches. I wasn't sure how well it would work, so I tried to move away from the two grizzlies. And immediately felt all of my careful camouflage slip off of me the second I started moving. Mama Grizzly roared at me. It was so deep it rattled me to my very soul. I was barely 50 feet away. She reared up on her hind legs, roared again, and as she came back down on all fours, she started to charge. I was inside the makeshift town, so there were lots of buildings I could duck into. Unfortunately, this was feudal Japan, where most of the internal walls were made out of genuine rice paper. The director was a stickler for realism. I ducked into a building, trying to break line of sight with the bear. I kept moving because there was no way I was going to stop until the constant thumping rumble of Mama Bear was silenced. I heard a crash as she bowled through some of the very interior walls that I was afraid wouldn't stop her. It did slow her, however, as she took a moment to rack up further expenses for the director. I ducked and weaved through the buildings, always seeking elevation without getting trapped. I found my way onto the roof of what I think was supposed to be a blacksmith, or the Japanese equivalent, and just waited. There were no ramps or stairs up to me, so if I stayed very quiet and very focused, I might not be noticed. Then I heard a wailing noise. The sound of a woman screaming. Not the scream of terror, like we hear so often in movies. The kind of sound that a practiced actress can make 100 times before she even gets tired. No. This was the guttural, awful, heart-rending shriek of a woman who has thrown caution to the wind and cares nothing for what her screams will do to her vocal cords. It was an expression of pure anguish. I heard the bear beneath me, and it stopped moving for a solid 20 seconds. It was still for the entire time the voice was screaming. And then it let out a and loped over to her cub. I was able to see them. She didn't even stop to let the cub trundle after her. She picked it up by the scruff of the neck and carried it away. I was left alone, panting on the roof. Ear-piercing scream nearby, but not danger close. I had most of my gear in a duffel bag, which I dropped when the bear chased me. I had my Colt and my Soulstone on me. I even had the foresight to create a little holster for the electrocauterizer so that it hung on my left hip. I had stitched a battery pack into a set of slots in my belt. It was worth the pricked fingers. I am not a seamstress. The problem was, the electrocauterizer was untested, and the Soulstone was only efficient once the spirit was weakened and tired of the fight. Like a fish on a line, any ghost I caught would struggle. Could I make it work? Sure, but it would be a hassle. And yes, Control, I was assuming the screaming woman was, in fact, the ghost I had come to find. I couldn't see her, though. I drew my pistol. There was no reason to, but with a Soulstone in my left hand and the familiar weight of the Colt in my right, I felt comfortable. I felt confident I could take on anything. I was ready for this. Without a warning, the roof I stood on collapsed. I fell something like 10 feet through the roof and bounced off of a prop anvil. Thank God it wasn't real metal, or I'd have broken several bones. It was some sort of rubber or hard plastic, so when I hit, it did hurt, but no real damage was done. Oh, and I twisted my left ankle when I landed. And my Soulstone fell out of my grasp. I also had a negligent discharge from my pistol and shot myself in the right leg. Look, all I'm saying is everything that could go wrong did go wrong, except I did not break my back. Whatever the mechanisms of this curse were, I'd been affected by it. Also, Control, I think this is the first time I've ever been shot. I have been cut, stabbed, slashed, suffered multiple head traumas, been rejected on dates, and had concussions, but this is the first time I've ever been injured by a gun. 0 out of 10 would not recommend. I lay there on the floor of the blacksmith set, bleeding and breathing heavily, when the screaming stopped. It was hard to not be really angry with myself. Jack had told me not to have my finger on the trigger if I couldn't see a target. So my injury was at least a little bit my fault. Self-recrimination aside, there was a ghost nearby. I was bleeding from my leg, and I didn't know where my Soulstone was in the immediate vicinity. As I considered my injury, I felt a cold chill run up my spine. In any other circumstance, I'd assume it was nerve damage from my fall. But in this case, yeah, definitely the ghost. Sometimes, the soul provides a physical reaction to the supernatural, while the mind is unable to process why. In this case, I was being warned that there was a hostile spirit in the area, and that she'd taken notice of me. I could slip into the Verambicio without the Soulstone, but I was in a great deal of pain. I couldn't focus enough to see the threads of reality. I cupped my right hand over the bullet wound, trying to stop the flow of blood. It wasn't working. I sat myself up and got out the cauterizer. I couldn't believe I'd be using it, even slightly, for its intended use. It provided a constant stream of electricity and was a genuine medical tool. Until I got my mitts on it. I figured at this point I would either stop the flow of blood and save my life, or, well, I might black out from the pain and die anyway. I just hoped the Soulstone was far enough away that it wouldn't suck me in. Well, nothing ventured, nothing gained. I clicked the voltage to max, took a deep breath, and had a genius thought. When a person undergoes electric shock, sometimes they accidentally bite their tongues off. So I made my first smart decision of the day and put my wallet in my mouth in order to bite that instead of my tongue. And then I touched the device to my leg. Control, it feels like every other report, I'm calling a new pain the worst thing I've ever experienced. And each time thus far it's been true. From now on, every other type of pain will be compared to the time I cauterized a bullet wound with my modified electrocauterizer. I set a new standard for sheer, unrelenting agony. My eyesight went white. My leg stiffened straight as multiple thousands of volts coursed through every nerve fiber in my body. I don't know if I had a heart attack or not, but my chest started hurting something fierce. I couldn't scream because of the wallet in my mouth. But I did let out a high-pitched droning noise that could only be compared to the test patterns on old TVs. The only reason I hadn't voided my bladder is because I hadn't had anything to drink since last night, and I was a little dehydrated. Because of how electricity works, my hand curled tighter on the electrocauterizer, keeping the juice flowing. I jammed it back into the wound every time it slipped away. I don't know how long I was touching lightning, but after what felt like an eternity, I decided to force it away from my body and observe the damage. I was lucky. The wound had sealed. I could smell the cooked meat. There was still a bullet inside somewhere, and there was a bit of worry about internal bleeding, but I wasn't going to bleed out externally. I was definitely going to have a scar, though. Panting and retching, I looked around me and saw the ghostly figure of a woman staring right at me. The right side of her face was sagging, as though she'd had a massive stroke. She had a look of almost awe on her face. She was dressed in a pure white dress of Japanese design. She was elevated on a pair of wooden sandals, but even still, she couldn't have been more than 5'1". She walked. She didn't float toward me. I tried to resist. I tried to stop her. I tried to do anything. After the electric shock, all I could do was mutter, She squatted down beside me and put her hand on my head. She said something in Japanese, and then she smiled. The left side of her face quirked up, while the right side remained sagging and deformed. I started breathing out a couple of grunts that almost kind of sounded like words. She smiled again, and this time, the distortion on her face lessened a little. I could see the right side of her mouth start to move in coordination with the left. With her left hand, she withdrew a handkerchief from somewhere, put it up to her mouth as though wetting it with saliva, and then touched my leg. And then I felt something. It wasn't the burning pain I would have expected. It wasn't the numbness that comes from nerve damage. It wasn't even the casual sensation that comes from being touched on exposed skin. Instead, I felt a cool, refreshing breeze wash over my whole body. My leg hurt significantly less. My heart had stopped racing, and I was able to draw a breath without feeling like I was hyperventilating. She looked at me again. This time her face was healed and beautiful. Still ghostly in appearance, though. Still somewhat translucent. But she gave me a full smile and quirked a little sitting bow. She said, pardon my butchered Japanese, Mishe waki arimasen. The extent of my Japanese comes from watching anime, but I know that masen is part of an apology. So I'm assuming she said, I'm sorry, somehow, kind of. I was able to smile a little bit myself and say, arigato. Once again, anime saves the day. Ugh. With a glance, she looked upwards and stood. Her back arced as she erupted in a cascade of light. With her left hand, she covered her mouth as she started laughing a pure, innocent laugh. Looking at me one last time, she said, Janne, and disappeared. I was left on the floor of a blacksmith shop, dazed, confused, but utterly convinced that the ghost of Oiwa would no longer trouble this set or anyone else ever again. I gathered my equipment, called 911, somehow my phone had survived the electric shock and fall, and sent a text to the director. Ghost fixed. Send someone to clean up blood. Also beware of bears. You can find me at the nearest hospital. I couldn't move, but I didn't hurt quite as much. I looked at the wound on my leg. It wasn't healed by any stretch of the imagination, but the burn didn't look as bad, even though I had still been shot. An ambulance arrived about 20 minutes later. It had a long way to travel to get to me. At the hospital, I was questioned by the police about my activities. I told them about the bear and accepted the ridicule of a police officer explaining gun safety to me in simple, childlike terms. They completely believed a slightly singed, city slicker, California gumshoe like myself could shoot himself by accident while being chased by a grizzly. I don't suspect Mr. Hattori is going to be having too many problems with the curse from now on. Do me a favor, Control. Bill him double for this one. I'm going to rest a little bit. Think I've earned it. Between this and last week. This is Jim Donovan, over and out.
Pinkerton's Ghosts is a podcast distributed by Superversive Radio, licensed under an attribution non-commercial, share-alike international license. This episode was written by Ken Dickerson and performed by the same. Ben Wheeler edits, directs, produces, and herds cats. Ken Dickerson performs our audio editing. Visit us on Facebook. Read articles on superversivesf.com or listen to us on Unauthorized, Acast, iTunes, or Spotify. Contact us through Twitter at @PinkertonsGhost, email us at PinkertonsGhosts@gmail.com, or send us noble messenger possums with messages strapped to their backs. Don't worry, they know how to find us. Thank you for listening, and good luck.